From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, Jake Gyllenhaal talks about his new role as a boxer in the film Southpaw. To prepare, he spent months learning how to box and defend himself.
Is that something you felt you didn't know before?
Yeah, I had been in fights in high school and unfortunately did not come out the victor. So I...
We'll also talk about Gyllenhaal's roles in Donnie Darko, Nightcrawler, and Brokeback Mountain. Also, we'll talk with Sean Baker, director of the new film Tangerine, about transgender sex workers, and Maya Taylor, one of the film's stars. She was transitioning to female while shooting Tangerine.
It was a very sensitive time. I went through life keeping shades on my face and covering up with a whole bunch of clothes. You know, during the filming, I was very comfortable, though. I guess because, you know, acting, it kind of took my mind away from that.
We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with Jake Gyllenhaal, who currently stars as a boxer in the new film Southpaw. Gyllenhaal has starred in the films Nightcrawler, End of Watch, Jarhead, Zodiac, Brokeback Mountain, and Donnie Darko. Gyllenhaal was 10 when he made his screen debut, playing Billy Crystal's son in the film City Slickers. He grew up surrounded by movie people. His father, Stephen, is a film director, and his mother, Naomi, is a screenwriter. Jake Gyllenhaal's older sister, you probably know, is actress Maggie Gyllenhaal. In the new film Southpaw, directed by Antoine Fuqua, Gyllenhaal plays boxer Billy Hope, an orphan who was raised in the foster care system and is now married with a daughter. After winning the light heavyweight title, his wife suggests it's time to stop because he's taken too many punches to his head and body. Billy Hope is prepared to follow her advice, but after a tragedy that results in him losing everything, he has to get back in the ring and try to make a comeback. Here he is early in the film, taking questions at a press conference after winning the championship.
Billy, most of us here had you winning this early. Were you expecting such a difficult fight?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. You can't expect anything. I was really looking forward to just showing up, walking the ring, and then having him fall on the ground.
Billy.
No, man, I expected a hard fight, you know. Put my family through a lot. By the way, Layla, if you're watching, go to sleep, baby.
Jake Gyllenhaal, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
You've said you didn't follow boxing before getting the part in Southpaw. So how did you get the part and why did you want it?
Yeah, I wasn't an avid boxing fan. I mean, I grew up in the 90s, so Tyson was obviously a staple of my upbringing, Mike Tyson. So I don't think you could really be breathing and not be a fan of his during that time. But I really didn't know much about it. And I think really the script was about a father and a daughter. It was about family and about a man really learning how to become a father, someone who had grown up in the foster care system and was an orphan, never really had a parent himself. His wife he met in the foster care system, and they had a child relatively young. And through a series of circumstances in his life, has to learn how to parent this child. And so that, to me, is what the movie was about. And the boxing was secondary. You know, I didn't know how to box when I started, and I knew in order to play a boxer and the way that Antoine Fuqua was going to shoot the movie, he said he was going to shoot it like a real HBO Showtime fight. So there would be no doubles, and we would be seeing my whole body move, and there wouldn't be any room to fake anything. I knew I had to actually learn how to box. But it was all motivated by the story that I fell in love with, which was really about a father and a daughter.
So you have a very developed body in this movie. I mean, it's all muscle, and it's all like well-formed muscle. What did you do to develop that?
I thought you were talking figuratively initially. So I was a well-formed body, and then I thought you were going to say of work, but no. Yes, yes,
body.
A well-formed body. It's true.
Well-formed body of body.
Well, I spent 5 months learning how to box. So over those 5 months, as I started to become more fluent in the language of boxing, you know, what happens is you learn combinations, or you learn offensive, defensive moves, and then you need your mind to be able to translate itself through your body. And so as you learn more, you need to be in better shape. And so over 5 months, you know, slowly sort of chipped away at it and gotten very, very, very good physical shape in order to kind of translate what had been taught to me skill-wise.
So unlike a costume, you don't take your body off when you come home. What was it like to have a different body?
Well, boxers are very much their body. That was an odd thing to sort of translate to myself. I mean, to be confident there, you know, you basically walk into a ring half naked, you know, and it's very primal in that way. It's all about a certain confidence. You know, even the choice, I have a tattoo on the back. You know, Billy Hope has this tattoo that says, "Fear no man," in the biggest block letters I've ever seen. And I really hesitated initially to put that on my back. You know, it was a last-minute choice. And I think going home and having that, you know, through essentially the 7 months of preparation for the movie and the shooting of the film, there's a confidence that comes from that. And more than that, in terms of how you look on the outside, I think my feelings about my endurance and my own strength and confidence, you know, it was life-changing, to be honest. I mean, I felt like sort of more confident internally than I had in my whole life. And that was not just due to the physical stuff. It was really due to learning boxing and knowing that I could defend myself if I needed to.
Is that something you felt you didn't know before?
Yeah. I had been in fights in high school and unfortunately did not come out the victor. So I that was something that was new to me.
Well, for the movie, you had to learn how to take punches on screen because your character is not famous for his defense. He's very good at channeling his anger and winning on that. So during the course of the film, you take a lot of punches. Your face is swollen and bloodied during parts of the film. How do you learn how to take punches without really getting hurt when you're filming?
Well, you know, in terms of getting hit, you know, I think that's inevitable. And it doesn't feel great, you know. I wouldn't recommend it, and I don't like getting hit, but it was important for the movie. At least that's how I justify it when I would get hit. That was good for the movie.
But you have to defend your face in real life. Your face is part of your tool. You know, as an actor,
right?
So, like, you don't want to have that kind of permanently swollen eye that some boxers end up with.
Right. Well, yeah. No, you don't. But I also feel like there's a preciousness to actors. There's a vanity that I definitely participate in, but I also don't necessarily agree with. So I like to challenge that.
So we've been talking about Southpaw, in which you play a kind of inarticulate boxer. And the movie you made before that, in 2014, Nightcrawler, was a very different character in the sense that, like, you really pumped your body up for Southpaw, and you actually got a more, like, hollowed out look. Not outlook, but hollowed out look for Nightcrawler. Kind of gaunt. Your eyes are, like, recessed and, like, kind of dark around them. So I want to play a clip from Nightcrawler before we talk about it. You play when the film starts, you're a small-time criminal who's got nothing. You have access to the internet, and you've read a lot of self-improvement stuff on the internet, and you tend to insert self-improvement quotes into all of your conversations. In the film, you eventually become a freelance cameraman who specializes in getting to crime scenes and car accidents and shooting graphic video for the kind of local TV news shows that program with the motto, "If it bleeds, it leads." But in the opening scene, you're just like a small-time criminal, and you've been cutting chain-link fences and stealing the fence just to sell for scrap metal. You've stolen manhole covers and copper to sell to scrap metal yards. And in this scene, you've been trying to sell the metals that you've stolen to the scrap metal guy, and you've been asking for a higher price than he's willing to pay. And so here you are making the final negotiation.
I'm willing to take less to establish a business relationship. If that's your last best offer, then I guess I accept.
All right, drive around back and unload them.
Excuse me, sir. I'm looking for a job. In fact, I've made up my mind to find a career that I can learn and grow into. Who am I? I'm a hard worker. I set high goals, and I've been told that I'm persistent. Now, I'm not fooling myself, sir. Having been raised with the self-esteem movement so popular in schools, I used to expect my needs to be considered. But I know that today's work culture no longer caters to the job loyalty that could be promised to earlier generations. What I believe, sir, is that good things come to those who work their asses off, and that people such as yourself who reached the top of the mountain didn't just fall there. My motto is, if you want to win the lottery, you have to make the money to buy a ticket. Did I say that I worked in a garage? So what do you say? I could start tomorrow, or even why not tonight?
No.
How about an internship, then? A lot of young people are taking unpaid positions to get a foot in the door. That's something I'd be willing to do.
I'm not hiring a thief.
That's my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal, in a scene from Nightcrawler. I just love you in that because, like, you're doing your lines as if your character has, like, memorized these things and can just, like, pull out these quotes as needed to recite, which seems exactly right to me. Memorizing lines about today's work culture and calling the scrap metal guy a guy who's made it to the top of the mountain.
Yep. The brilliant words of Dan Gilroy.
So can you tell us how you developed your voice for this role? And I just don't mean the placement of your voice, but like the whole affect that you're going for.
Well, I figured the only way we were going to have an hour and a half long movie and not a 3 hour long movie with all the soliloquies that this character gives was if he had speed, number one. And number two, I think I tried to memorize all of them as fast as I could. You know, we didn't have a lot of time while we were shooting the film. I knew we wouldn't. We shot the movie in 22 days. And I figured, you know, I would need to have some pace on them. And I also figured in terms of selling, you need to move quick. You know, people aren't going to listen for very long and you need to get a lot of information out very quickly. So I memorized them at a breakneck speed. I had to sort of slow them down actually when we were shooting because sometimes they were too fast. I mean, I can recite that speech even now.
Oh, do you know, it.
as fast as I can.
Yeah.
I can. Excuse me, sir, I'm looking for a job. In fact, I made up my mind to find a career that I can learn and grow into. Who am I? I'm a hard worker. I set high goals and I've been told that I'm persistent. I'm not fooling myself, sir. Having been raised with the self-esteem movement so popular in schools, I used to expect my needs to be considered. But I know that today's work culture no longer caters to the job loyalty that could be promised to earlier generations. What I believe, sir, is that good things come to those who work their asses off. And, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Bravo. But that's great. But I love that because this is a person who doesn't have genuine feelings. He knows yes. what a feeling. He knows what a feeling is supposed to sound like when it's expressed. So he memorizes things that sound like they're expressing feelings, but he's never really expressing anything. You know what I mean?
No, there are these moments.
He doesn't feel any genuine emotion.
No,
outside of anger. Yeah.
I don't mean to laugh at that. I just there is sort of a funny thing when Dan Gilroy would come to me. There's a scene with Rene Russo, who's brilliant in the movie, where he tells her why he wants to work in television news. And the direction that Dan gave me was, ask her to marry you. And it has nothing to do with marriage in any way. But from this speech, he said, like, give it like you were going to ask her to marry you. And it's all about how he wants to be in the local television news business. And somehow there's this sort of strange fake emotion underneath it that he knows nothing about. And in a weird way, neither did I while I was doing it. I was just saying these words and trying to give them a feeling. And I think that's kind of what Lou is about, is just picking up these feelings he sees other people have and then translating them into things he's picked up off the internet.
Did you end up reading self-improvement books just to get into his mindset?
I only read self-improvement.
No, I'm sure.
That I'm actually reading a great one right now.
That's how you got to where you are today.
Yeah. I mean, they will change your life. I listen to a lot of those self-improvement tapes because he listens to them at the beginning of the movie. You can kind of hear them early on. But really, I really use the screenplay in the case of that movie as my Bible. You know, there's rarely dialogue like that. Nowadays, And I never veered from a period. I never veered from a comma. I never improvised anything in the movie. I did go with the guys who do the job that Lou Bloom does. And I had done a movie a few years before Nightcrawler called End of Watch about two police officers in Southeast LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 5 months on the streets with police officers preparing for that and saw so many things.
Did you see things from a different angle driving around with the police in LA as research for End of Watch than you saw things when you were driving around with TV news cameramen?
Yeah. I mean, in the case of working with police officers and the incredible, you know, LAPD police officers that I worked with, you know, I saw death. I saw really the hardest sides of humanity there and saw how extraordinary the work of police officers can be. And I think sometimes, maybe rightfully so, they've gotten a hard time and been given a hard time and constantly do. But I was amazed at the work that I saw. And, you know, I wasn't going on a ride-along, you know, like you would go on a few ride-alongs. I spent months and months with four or five different sets of partners in both the Sheriff's Department and Los Angeles Police Department. And it changed my life. So it was an interesting evolution from End of Watch to Nightcrawler.
You were kind of born into a movie family. Your father, Stephen Gyllenhaal, is a director. Your mother, Naomi Foner Gyllenhaal, is a screenwriter. They're divorced now, but they were together when you were growing up. You were 10 years old when you got your first movie role. That was as Billy Crystal's son in the film City Slickers, which I confess I haven't seen.
What, Terry?
Yeah, sorry. How did you get the part?
Yeah, I remember I went to some sort of party, I think, with my parents, and Billy Crystal was there, and he saw me, and he said, you know, will he come in and read for this movie I have? You know, he's funny, and I guess I must have been acting out if you spent more time with me in real life, you would see I like to act out. And so I was making some fool out of myself, and I think I remember what happened was he was leaving, and I knew who he was, and I picked up a chair from the table, and I said, here, take this. This is your party favor.
What?
And, yeah, that's just me. It doesn't make much sense, but he loved it, and he thought it was really funny.
So apparently once you got that role in City Slickers, you wanted to act more. You auditioned for other roles, and your parents let you audition, but they wouldn't let you actually take a job if you got the part. So
yep.
What was the philosophy behind that?
They believed in education over everything else. And they said, you know, you're about to start junior high school. It's a really, really important time in your life, though you probably can't see that now. And we believe that you need to go to school. And I thank them so much for that.
Because?
Because it only gave me more drive. You know, it only made me say, well, when I get older, I'm really going to try and do this because I really like doing it. And because I have an education. Because when I read a screenplay or when I read a book or there's something that I want to make into a story, I have had the privilege of reading the great books and using my own mind to interpret them. Because of that, it's given me an opportunity to find and believe in projects like Nightcrawler, you know, or Southpaw, where I say, you know, I've seen this story, but how can we do it differently?
The first role I think that really put you on the map was Donnie Darko. Hmm. And you play a high school student who starts seeing this kind of giant rabbit that talks to him, a kind of imaginary friend. And Donnie Darko thinks he's being given secret information about the impending end of the world. And we're not sure if he actually has access to secret information or if it's a psychiatric issue that's been mm-hmm. aggravated because he doesn't always take his pills. So I just want to play a short scene. And here you are with your psychiatrist, and you're talking to her about a very old kind of disheveled woman named Roberta Sparrow, who most of the kids in the neighborhood are kind of scared of her. But recently you saw her walking kind of addled in the middle of the road, and you tried to help her. she whispered something in your ear. And this has to do with the whole end of the world scenario that you think that you're getting. So here you are talking to your psychiatrist about this old woman, Roberta Sparrow.
She was just standing there in the middle of the road, frozen. So I got out of the car and I walked over to see if she was okay. And she leaned over and whispered in my ear.
What did she say?
I mean, I think Frank wants me to go talk to her, you know, because the last time I saw him, he asked me if I knew about time travel, and she wrote a book about it, so that can't be like a coincidence, right?
Donnie, what did Roberta Sparrow say to you?
She said that every living creature on Earth dies alone.
How did that make you feel?
It reminded me of my dog, Callie. She died when I was 8, and she crawled underneath the porch.
To die.
To be alone.
Do you feel alone right now?
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to believe I'm not, but I've just never seen any proof, so I just don't debate it anymore, you know? It's like I could spend my whole life debating it over and over again, weighing the pros and cons, and in the end, I still wouldn't have any proof, so I just don't debate it anymore. It's absurd.
The search for God is absurd?
It is if everyone dies alone.
Does that scare you?
I don't want to be alone.
That's my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal, in a scene from Donnie Darko. What impact did this movie have on your life? How old were you when you made it?
I was 19 or 20.
Yeah. And were you in college at that point?
I had dropped out of college, actually. I did 2 years of college, and then I went and started working pretty consistently. So, for all this talk of education, I am a college dropout. But I am also full of contradictions. So, but I remember, and that's part of it. You know, I was at Columbia, which is an extraordinary school in New York City, and I think I was searching for this creative outlet. I didn't really know at the time that that's what I was searching for. And I was going through at 19, you know, this – eventually my parents got divorced, but there was a lot of things going on there. And I think I was just sort of trying to figure out what it was like to be an adult and what being an adult was. And when I read that script, I remember very clearly thinking, wow, because it was at the time when all of those movies about, you know, high school movies and the movies about high school were about who was going to go to the prom or, you know, who was going to go to the party and get accepted in the cool kids club. And this was
how you were going
about
to lose your virginity.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was a movie about high school, but it was about the internal ride that is adolescence. And I was a bit of a mess as a kid that age, and I read it and I went, wow, this is really what I'm feeling, more so than just more so than just like I hope I can go to the popular kids party.
Well, you said you were a bit of a mess. What do you mean?
Well, I mean I was an adolescent. I mean, you know, I think you know, it's that age where you're moving in, you're moving out of a life that's protected and safe into a world that is the reality of the world with all the things that come with it, and I think things become more scary and a little bit more dangerous and more fun and exciting, and trying to navigate through those things are all, you know, what being an adolescent, sort of trying to figure out what that is into adulthood is about.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jake Gyllenhaal, and he's now starring in the new film Southpaw. Let's go back to 2005 when Brokeback Mountain was released, and you and Heath Ledger played two men who fall in love one summer while tending sheep on Brokeback Mountain in Wyoming. But they each marry women and have children. Once a year, they return to Brokeback Mountain together. But this relationship is kept very, very secret. This scene takes place 20 years into their relationship at the end of one of their visits. It ends up being the last time they see each other. Your character speaks first.
Yeah, we'll try this one. And I'll say it just once.
Go ahead.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together. Real good life. Had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain. Everything's built on that. That's all we got, boy. F***ing all. So I hope you know that if you don't ever know the rest. You count the damn few times that we have been together in nearly 20 years, and you measure the short leash you keep me on, and then you ask me about Mexico, and you tell me you kill me for needing something I don't hardly never get. You have no idea how bad it gets. And I'm not you. I can't make it on a couple of high altitude once or twice a year. You are too much for me, Ennis. You son of a horse and bitch. I wish I knew how to quit you.
Then why don't you? Why don't you just let me be, huh? It's because of you, Jack, that I'm like this. I'm nowhere. Oh.
It's a scene from Brokeback Mountain in 2005 with Heath Ledger and my guest, Jake Gyllenhaal. When you made that scene, did you think, I wish I knew how to quit you would become a famous line?
No, not in any form, anywhere and anywhere in my mind. All I could think about was the love between these two people, you know, and it has since become something, you know, praised and mocked and many other things. And it's very interesting.
This might be too personal, so you just tell me because I don't want to intrude.
Yeah.
Was Heath Ledger the first peer? The first friend you were close with who died?
Yeah.
I just think it's different, you know, when somebody your age, someone who you've worked with, one of your contemporaries you're close to dies. It's just different from other deaths.
Yeah. He was an incredibly special, and that doesn't even come close to encapsulating who he is. Who he was, it is different. I think, you know, as an actor, like I said when we started talking earlier about, you know, vanity and living in a sort of bubble. You know, I think sometimes reality doesn't. You don't get. You don't always get a sense of that, and I think that's a proper criticism of the entertainment industry. And I think that's why I like to go off and I like to try and get into worlds that will wake me up. And when you say, do you like getting punched? Like, I don't like getting punched, but I don't think like, ooh, you know, maybe this is going to be not good for the next thing. I'm trying to be present where I am. I'm trying to have relationships that are as real as they possibly can be on a movie set. Be close to people because I know that it's precious. And I know not only like can that this career end in a very short period of time and this or that can happen, but also that life is precious. And I think losing Heath and being a part of a family that was something like that movie we all made together, you know, makes you see that, makes you appreciate that, and hopefully moves you away from the things that really don't matter to the things that do.
Jake Gyllenhaal stars in the new movie Southpaw. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Sean Baker, who directed and co-wrote the new comedy-drama film Tangerine, which is about two trans women who are sex workers in Los Angeles. Maya Taylor, one of the stars of Tangerine, is also Terry's guest. You should know that parts of Terry's conversation will be about sex workers and may not be appropriate for children. The two trans sex workers in Tangerine are Alexandra, an African-American woman played by our guest Maya Taylor, and her friend Cindy, a Hispanic woman played by Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, who has just returned to the neighborhood after 28 days in jail. In the opening scene, the two women are in a donut shop talking about what happened on the block while Cindy was in prison. To understand the dialogue, you need to know that Chester, the guy they're going to talk about, is Cindy's boyfriend and a pimp. And the word fish is used here as a slang term for a woman born with a woman's anatomy. Our guest Maya Taylor is the second voice you'll hear.
So, I got some good news to tell you.
What?
I've been keeping a secret about me and Chester.
Girl. Woo! I know what it is! Okay. You're breaking up with him. Thank God. Because, what? Honey, for him to be cheating on you like that...
Wait. What?
You didn't know?
How would I know?
Girl, because everything that you've been hearing on the block about the girl that he's been with.
Girl, you're the first girl I've seen on the block.
You...
Who is she?
Girl, she's some white fish. I don't know.
Chester's fish, you know me, with real fish.
Like a real fish, girl, like vagina and everything.
I've been gone for 28 days, and you mean to tell me that he's been out here cheating on me with fish?
Yeah.
Do I know her?
I don't know. I just know that her name starts with a D. It's something like Danielle, Desiree... DD. I don't know, girl.
Give me your phone.
It was shut off.
How
I had to cover your rent last month.
Maya Taylor, Sean Baker, welcome to Fresh Air. Sean Baker, let me start with you. Why did you want to make a movie about transgender sex workers?
Well, to tell you the truth, I live about a half a mile from the corner of Santa Monica and Highland. And I moved out to Los Angeles about 3 years ago, and I was drawn to that location. I started to realize that there was so much of Los Angeles that had not been covered in film and television. And this was one of those locations that just drew me in. You know, it's sort of a infamous intersection, an unofficial red light district. And I thought, you know, there must be some incredible stories that take place on that corner.
So you assumed that there were interesting stories on this corner. How did you go about finding what some of those stories might be?
Well, my co-screenwriter, Chris Bragash, and I, we wanted to find a collaborator. And this is very similar to the way I make all of my films. So, you know, there's a long research process where we literally have to just pound the pavement, introduce ourselves to people, and get to know people, and then find a collaborator. And in this case, for a couple of weeks, we would show up, walk around the area, say hello. We weren't getting very far. Eventually, we made our way around the corner to the LGBT Center, which is on McCadden, about a block away from the corner of Santa Monica and Highland. And we saw Maya Taylor hanging out with some of her friends in the courtyard. And there was just something about, you know, something about Maya. She attracted our attention from 40 feet away. And we went up to her and introduced ourselves and started talking about this project. And it was that eureka moment where, like, she expressed enthusiasm back to us. And we exchanged, you know, contact information, and then we just started our research from there. She was really our passport to that world. She was that collaborator we were looking for.
Maya, what's your take on that moment when Sean comes up to you and wants you to help him make his movie? Were you thinking maybe he's a cop? Were you thinking maybe he's really just like a, a con of some sort? Like, did you really believe that he made movies and that he was capable of making a good movie about that neighborhood and the people in it?
Well, I didn't think that he was a cop or anything because I wasn't doing anything that I wasn't supposed to be doing. So I did believe him. I mean, because it's obvious, like, if you IMDb him, you know, it all pulls up and everything. And
right, with his photo.
yeah, with his photo and everything on it. He was extremely adorable and approachable. He really is. And I was like, okay, well, let's talk about this. You know, I couldn't pass up the opportunity to get involved with a movie.
Were you already interested in performing?
I was very interested in performing. Because I always wanted to be just a full-on entertainer. I wanted to sing, act, dance, and model.
Maya, you were beginning to transition to female when you started making the movie. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Yeah, that is correct.
It strikes me as a very unusual period to find yourself on camera, because just as you're emerging as an authentic self that you feel you've been but haven't expressed fully before, you're being captured on camera in a character, in a character that's not you. So was it a challenging time to act in front of a camera, or was it actually a good time to do that?
You know, when I look back at it now, I have to say, you know, it was a pretty good time because it really does fit the role and everything, because they're supposed to be living a hard life and everything. So at that time, you probably couldn't tell that I was taking hormones and doing all of that. I just started. So, you know, maybe the character couldn't afford hormones or anything. You know, I think about stuff like that. But it was a very sensitive time of my life, because I went through life with my transition, keeping shades on my face and covering up with a whole bunch of clothes like turtlenecks or jackets and things, because I wasn't comfortable with my body or with my face at that time, because I knew that it wasn't developed to the way that I wanted it to be, and I knew that it was going to take a few years. So, you know, during the filming and everything, I was very comfortable, though, because of the crew and Sean and Kiki. You know, those are the two people that I'm closest to. But I was very comfortable during the whole thing. I guess because, you know, acting, it kind of took my mind away from that.
So one of the main storylines in the movie has to do with after Kiki tells your character, Maya, that, you know, she's out for revenge, you go, I'm not coming with you unless you promise me there's no drama. Because your character really wants to avoid drama, especially since she has a singing engagement that night at a little bar. And so she's that's her thing that day. And she doesn't want any distractions from that. But from that moment on, there's nothing but drama. It's like...
It is.
Everything
it
starts
is.
To go
true.
Wrong. Nothing but drama. Is this a community in which there's a lot of drama? And have you tried
there
to...
There is a lot of drama all the time. That's why I normally try to avoid it.
I really do. Is it hard to avoid?
It is pretty hard to avoid. Let me just go ahead and give you the backstory.
Sure.
So you have to ask yourself, what is Cindy and Alexandra doing out in the streets? You know, what are they doing, sex working and, you know, doing all these horrible things and everything? Well, I can't tell you how they got out there because they're characters, but, you know, I can tell you how I got out there. So, yes, everybody, I've done sex work in my life, and it's not fun, it's not easy, and it's nothing that you can just get used to. I was pretty much thrown away from my family when I came out to them when I was 18. And I pretty much grew up with my grandparents, and they didn't take it too well, you know, when I came out to them. So I was forced to leave, and I left, and I moved to LA with another family member who actually treated me horribly. But I was forced out to the streets, and I became homeless and everything because I didn't have anybody. And I didn't really know too much about my biological mom at that time, which I'm very close to now, you know. I got closer to her and I love her and she's very supportive of my transition. And she actually came up with the name Maya. My name comes from Jeremiah being changed to Maya. But yeah, I was forced out to the streets and I came across a youth center. At that time, it was called the Jeff Griffith Youth Center. And I went to the center and they helped me a lot with housing and everything and to pretty much get myself back on my feet. But I was constantly surrounded by all these sex workers and drug dealers in the area. And I needed money and I was applying for all these jobs over and over and over. And I was like, why am I not getting any jobs? So eventually I started applying for more. I did like 146 jobs in 1 month. And the last month that I applied for jobs before all this movie stuff was 186 jobs. And I found myself being discriminated against and I could actually prove it. So you have to ask yourself, you know, why are there so many sex workers on Santa Monica and Highland? Me personally, I did it because I could not get a job.
So you mentioned that when you became homeless, for a while, the only thing you could do to make money was
sex work.
Right. And
I tell you, you never get used to that. It's it's about, you know, when you're getting inside of a car with somebody, it's scary as it is because you never know what they could do to you. Or you never know if they're a cop that's going to take you to jail. Like, it's really, really, really scary. And I think I was more scared of, you know, being taken to jail, which I had been already quite a few times for doing that.
How do you identify who's a potential trick?
You can tell. Like, I would post ads and, you know, then there was certain people that would come to my page or whatever and they just... I don't know, like, you know, they talk to me and everything, and then I determine whether I want to go see them or not. Or if I'm on the streets, you can kind of tell because they come up to you and, you know, they blow their horn or they roll down their window or whatever.
It was also those guys who would cruise.
Exactly. And, you know, the whole time, like, every time I got out there, my heart was always just pounding and pounding. And it pounded even harder when a car would pull up because... I know that this person is here, but I know that I need this money.
My guests are Maya Taylor, who stars in the new film Tangerine, and Sean Baker, who directed and co-wrote it and served as the co-cinematographer. So, Sean, I want to ask you about how you shot Tangerine. And this is becoming a famous story in the film world, but you shot it on an iPhone, a 5S iPhone. Which isn't even a 6. It's like it's not even the latest model with a larger screen.
Well, we did shoot a year and a half ago
when the 6
wasn't available.
Okay,
so.
Then. It really looks good. What did you do to customize the cell phone camera to make it film worthy?
Well, yeah. First off, this all stemmed from just us having no budget, a very small budget. And we had already written out our script and we knew we had to put a lot of production value up on the screen. You know, we had multiple locations, an ensemble cast. We couldn't afford the higher end cameras. That's basically what it came down to. So so once we decided to go down this route with the iPhone, though, it was really about doing whatever we could do to elevate it to a cinematic level. And I came across this Kickstarter campaign for this company called Moondog Labs, and they created an anamorphic adapter which fits over the iPhone lens. It's a tiny little thing. It's about it's like the size of a matchbook, and it actually, what it does is that it allows you to shoot in true scope. So it's real, it's widescreen cinema that you're capturing on your iPhone. And that in conjunction with this app called Filmic Pro, which anybody can get on their iPhone, basically it locks the camera 24 frames a second. It has all these other bells and whistles like locking aperture and focus and just creating a more professional look that you can get from the video that you on the iPhone. And then, of course, you know, heavy color grading and post, adding grain, trying to emulate film. You know, when it comes down to it, I'm in love with film. I'm I'm a cinephile. If I had the choice, I would have shot this on film. If I had the budget, I would have shot this on film. But, you know, sometimes you just have to make with the most of what you have, and that's exactly how this came about.
Sean, why did you want to make this movie about trans sex workers in L.A. a comedy, or at least partially a comedy?
Well, I've always...
Maybe I can answer that better.
Would you like to answer that?
Yeah, I had to take that because Sean talks too slow. So, you know, you remember I'm a collaborator, you know, when it comes to making a film. And I told Sean I wanted the story to be very real and I wanted it to be very funny because, like, who wants a theater full of crying people? Like, nobody has time for that. Like, I like to see people laugh and everything. And think about what these girls are going through. They're so low in their life that, you know, all you can do is think to go up. So laugh about everything. Like, make life fun.
Did you
At
also?
At least that's what I did.
Did you also not want the film to be about the tragic plight of trans sex workers?
Well, it's not... The film is not about trans sex workers. It just happens to have sex workers in it. Well, as characters. It's more about friendship, so...
Right. When Maya actually said that to me very early on in the process...
About the comedy?
She actually said to me that, you know, she wanted me to make this hilarious, which... You know, I have to say, there was that, it's dangerous. You know, I'm a cisgender white male coming from outside, and I'm trying to make this film, and suddenly I'm asked to make it into a full-out comedy. And I was, I didn't know exactly how I would go about doing that. It seemed like too hard of a balancing act. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that what Maya was asking was to make, you know, was to make pop, was to make something that would actually appeal and pull in the general audiences and mainstream audiences, because, you know, that's how you communicate to the mainstream, through pop, and part of pop is comedy. So I realized that this request was actually really something that I have to say that I was very thankful that she had this request, because I'm not sure I would have gone down this road without her guidance on it. And then once we started going down that road and we started starting making humor part of the dialogue, it also translated into the style of the film. You know, there's humor in the cutting, there's humor in the music cues, there's even humor in some of the camera moves. So yes, it's something that I was very apprehensive about at first, but then I realized that it was the only way to go, because it wasn't condescending to the subjects.
Sean Baker directed and co-wrote the new comedy-drama film Tangerine. Maya Taylor is one of the film's stars. You can hear a longer version of their conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.